This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark AmTower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. AmTower Off-Center with your host, Mark AmTower.
Welcome to AmTower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest today is Kevin DeSanto of Kips DeSanto. Kevin, welcome back to the show. It's been a while.
Mark, thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to chat today.
And good to have you back. I mean, we're Kips DeSanto. I'll let you explain what Kips DeSanto is.
Sure. So we're an investment banking firm based in Tysons Corner. We're a group that focuses on providing merger and acquisition and financing advisory work to private companies in the aerospace, defense, and government industry, and generally work with lower middle market companies that are trying to figure out ways for their shareholders to get liquidity, oftentimes through the sale of a company or raising outside capital, both debt and equity. And also focusing on helping companies and their stakeholders set strategies that are going to build value over time. So from a firm vantage point, we think about enterprise value. We think about how we can ultimately grow and enhance the business from a shareholder vantage point and help those companies and those shareholders through the more meaningful and monumental transactions of their company lives, and ultimately a lot of times the careers and personal lives of the folks that are involved get to be affected pretty significantly as well. So a fun job and a fun group of people. We've been at this independently for the last 8 years since the beginning of 2007, and looking for at least another 8 more if things keep going the way that they have been.
At least 8 more. You're young. It's going to be 28 more. So two things. Define low and mid-market, and then talk a little bit about how you and Bob started this gig.
Sure. So lower mid-market for us is generally companies that are below $500 million in revenue or enterprise value. That tends to be the bulk of the companies in the aerospace, defense, and government industry that are involved in transaction activity, and is a great place for us to be able to bring our capability set to bear because of the fact that most of our clients haven't been through these types of transactions before and aren't generally experienced in the ways of corporate finance or sophisticated transaction activity. And so it's a great place for us to be able to get in and advise and coach and work with these businesses. It also tends to be the part of the market that is getting gobbled up by the bigger companies or the investors in the industry as well. For us, we got started. Bob and I had worked together for a number of years before we did this, and ultimately felt like we could put ourselves in a position to build a firm that was highly specialized, and in today's day and age felt like that was a significant differentiator. And an important component of being an advisor to our clients was not having conflicts of interest with other business lines or other product or services of a larger firm, and being in a position where we could really cater to our clients' needs and not those of a larger P&L or a larger organization. So we really enjoyed the idea of being in that position. And I'd say the third piece for us was a goal to be entrepreneurial and to be out experiencing the same types of dynamics that our clients were experiencing. And while I fundamentally believe we've got a long way to go, we certainly do experience things in a more personal way. And ultimately, I feel like that helps us advise our clients on these types of transactions.
Okay. Now, a week or so back, I sent you an article when Jill Otoro was still at WBJ. Her second to last article, the headline was the M&A drought is over. I took some umbrage to the title because I didn't really see a drought occur. You know, Potomac TechWire, WashTech, I'm looking at these things on a regular basis, and there's deals all the time. So give me your take on that. And then you showed me a five-year chart a little while ago. So run through the stats on that as well, please.
Sure. I think the idea of a drought is always relative. And one of the things that we saw in really early 2013, specifically related to companies that were supporting the government, was that there was a lull in the market in terms of M&A transaction announcements in that first 6 months of 2013. And that was really twofold. One was that capital gains tax rates were going up in 2013, so there was a rush to get transactions completed in 2012. And then the second piece was that we had the threat or sort of the pending shutdown of the government that occurred in October of that year. So there was a lot of uncertainty in the marketplace. It led to a number of different things happening at the buyer or investor level, reestablishing what your priorities were as an organization, making sure that you were spending money in places that were going to be long-term beneficiaries of government spending. And then the third piece was that there was a lot of internal focus in really trying to retrench and reorient to be a viable competitor in a market where a lot of fundamental aspects of the business were changing. We hear a lot about LPTA. We hear a lot about contract vehicles that are reducing the competitive landscape. There's a lot of different things that were happening in this market in addition to the budget situation. And so we ended up with what I would characterize as a lull in 2013. But that really was a six-month period. The last 18-plus months since the summer of 2013 have been very active in terms of the volume of transaction activity. We're not quite back to where we were pre-2013 when we were experiencing about 100 deals a year on average for mergers and acquisitions, but we're at about 75 deals a year on average over the last couple of years and into 2015, and that is a relatively healthy pace. Certainly for us in our business, we'd love to see more of it, but it feels like there is enough activity that we're really in a position where the drought that was in our minds a very short one is over. But definitely the market has changed and is different today than it was 3-4 years ago. So there's a lot of that sort of changing market landscape in that drought commentary as well from my vantage point.
Okay. So what's the driving factor here for the government technology market, the M&A activity? What are the factors that come into play?
A lot of different factors. Certainly, some of these are very, very company-specific or buyer-specific. And there's different drivers from both the buy side and the sell side. So thinking about it from the buyer side or the investor side today, the activity is being driven by, I would say, kind of three core factors for these businesses. One is looking to establish or continue to bolster competitive positioning within a customer. So there's a lot of focus on where do we want to be, who do we want to be supporting, and trying to find acquisition targets that are going to fill the void or bolster an existing position. One of the interesting things about this market over the last couple of years is that we've seen about 2/3 of the transaction activity focus on defense and intelligence related businesses. And so, people trying to figure out ways to get into customers that are ultimately going to be positioned over the longer term, versus 1/3 of the transaction activity being focused on civilian agency contractors over that period of time. The second area that we're seeing buy-side activity or buyer interest is in developing capabilities that they may not have today. And that is either through the acquisition of service capabilities. Specifically, we hear things like cybersecurity, mobility, big data analytics, a lot of the things that are kind of buzzwords in the industry today, focusing on building out that services capability. And then the kind of the second characterization of what they're trying to buy from a capability vantage point is the technology. There is an active interest from almost every organization that we talk to in trying to find ways to acquire intellectual property or to acquire technology assets that are going to help them differentiate themselves in this marketplace, potentially drive a more efficient solution to their customer, potentially differentiate themselves in a way that they can't through traditional labor-based contracting or support services. The third area that we're seeing is that the sort of financial arbitrage is available in today's market, primarily because of the ability to borrow money at such low interest rates. And so this environment has provided companies the ability to essentially use their balance sheets in an extremely efficient fashion and go out and acquire assets at a cost of capital that is well below what they have experienced historically. And frankly, what we expect to experience over the course of the next 2 to 3 years as interest rates begin to increase. So there is a dynamic right now where it's incredibly efficient to spend money on larger investments or in acquisitions because of the fact that the cost of the capital is so low from the buyer side. So on the sell side, you know, kind of think of it in three buckets as well. A lot of the transaction activity that we see today.
Let's pick up the sell side on the other side of the commercial.
That sounds good.
Cool. My guest today is Kevin DeSanto of Kipps DeSanto. You can find them at Kipps, K-I-P-P-S, DeSanto.com. I'm Mark Amtower. You're listening to Amtower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Amtower Off-Center on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guest today is Kevin DeSanto of Kipps DeSanto, M&A firm involved in both the government arena and the aerospace side of defense. But you migrate a little bit out of aerospace. The aerospace you cover is also non-government sometimes.
Yeah, there is some commercial aerospace in there. And the interesting part about our focus areas is that it ends up that about half of our clients are in the sort of mid-Atlantic region. Mm. And then the balance are spread out across the country. Big government installations, think of places like Norfolk or Hampton Roads, Virginia, mm-hmm. or down to Charleston, South Carolina, Huntsville, Alabama, and then especially from an aerospace vantage point, places like the Pacific Northwest and Southern California.
Just a little bit there.
Just
so
a little bit. Right?
Let's go back to that sell side.
Yeah, and one of the things that we were talking about is what drives buyers to want to do transactions, and I think it's equally important to think about what drives the seller's view of when they want to do a transaction. And I was saying just before break that we kind of view three major catalysts for what a seller might be looking to achieve or why they might be looking to move into a deal in the current environment. One of the biggest reasons is that the last few years have been really tough. So there's a lot of folks that are tired and worn out. And ultimately, feel like if they've stabilized or they've been able to grow their business after a tough couple of years, that now's the time to go out and maybe take some chips off the table or reduce their own risk profile of their ownership in a business. And so that's been a meaningful driver of a lot of the interest and activity over the course of the last 12 months. The second component of it is that there are opportunities to generate significant liquidity for shareholders given the buyer interest. And so we've seen a lot of conversations that have been started by a preemptive phone call from a buyer saying, hey, you guys look like a great fit. Let's get this conversation started. And oftentimes that may not be the ultimate buyer of the business, but it does get our clients or prospective clients thinking about what they might want to do outside of that one preemptive discussion. And then the third piece of it is that in today's day and age, there are some benefits to being a part of a larger organization, potentially a more efficient footprint that allows you to compete at or lower rates, or allows you to have access to a contract vehicle, or allows you the ability to leverage somebody else's bid and proposal, capture management, things like that, that can supercharge a business. And we see a lot of folks that are looking for ways to be partnered and or aligned with other organizations that are going to create efficiencies and opportunity that they can't create independently in this market.
Okay. Now, we've had private discussions kind of around this before, but what about a small company that owns a suite of contracts that another firm might be covetous of?
The contract vehicles and the task orders and associated work is the big driver for a lot of the buyer interest when it's narrow in focus or it has an identity to it. So a lot of times what we see are smaller companies that are kind of singular in their in their nature, whether it's a heavily focused capability set or it's a heavily focused customer environment, that tends to have a lot of value to larger organizations because they're trying to create these beachheads. They're trying to position themselves in places where there is money flowing. And so we're seeing a lot of that activity. One of the challenges in this marketplace is that the SBA and the way the regulations are set up with respect to set-aside awards of contracts or vehicles creates a lot of complications in those situations. And so, you know, there's a lot of nuances that go into this, but we do see a lot of that activity where there are smaller companies that are getting purchased by more than likely kind of the next tier. So your $50, $100, $150 million business buying your $5, $10, $15 million business tends to be the type of experience that we see. We don't typically see the $1 billion, $2, $3, $4 billion revenue businesses acquiring those small companies because it just doesn't move the needle for them.
Right. And if they wanted a piece of those contracts, most likely they have contract shops that will have the bid, no bid thing, and they've got reasons for not having pursued.
That's right. So. And that's a big internal thought process, and frankly should be for any company that's listening to us today, is thinking it like a public company and trying to make sure that you're aligning your capital spend with what is going to ultimately drive a return on your investment or is going to increase your equity value or your enterprise value as a business. And that's one of the things that we spend a lot of time with the private companies in the industry is helping them think about, should I be buying or should I be selling? If I'm going to sell, when am I going to sell? And if I'm going to sell, you know, 2, 3, 4 years down the road, what do I have to do today in order to build that enterprise value? Should I be acquiring other assets? Should I be looking for contract vehicles? Should I be overspending on B&P? Should I be recruiting that senior level talent into the organization? All of those things are critical factors and critical things for folks to be focused on and trying to align them in a way that's going to match up with the risk reward and the type of timeline that you're on as an owner is one of the more challenging but one of the more important things that we see in the industry.
And we do have a laundry list of items for companies selling to think about, but we'll get to that a little later on. Let's talk about some of the big deals that have come down the pike or that seem to be coming down the pike. So let's SAIC, the split from the science applications to the pizza place.
an interesting company in progression, and we've seen this a few times over the last number of years where the larger companies are looking to establish value by essentially kind of separating and becoming independent and becoming identified differently than they are as the larger combined organization. We've seen that with SAIC splitting with Leidos and with examples of Excellus spinning off Vectorus and L3 spinning off Engility. And now you have more public companies in the industry as a result of that activity. And frankly, better defined strategies and missions around a lot of those companies and organizations. And I think that there is there's an ability to, from a private company vantage point, look at those examples and learn about what creates value or ultimately what complicates value in a lot of these situations. You're looking at, you know, lower margin businesses being separated from higher margin businesses or businesses that sit on the performer side of the government contracting relationship versus on the advisory side. A lot of different things that can restrict value or restrict competition ultimately led to those types of decisions to split up these larger organizations. And again, we see a lot of those same dynamics playing out in smaller companies in the industry as well. But you know, once these guys ultimately kind of become independent public companies, you end up with situations where they have to retool and sort of start to think about what is going to change their business over time. SAIC and Cytor being a great example, the acquisition that was announced a few months ago, you know, gives SAIC an opportunity to really enhance its intelligence community presence. Very little overlap between the two organizations based on what the companies have disclosed publicly. So it looks like a very strategic move by SAIC in that direction. And we've seen that a number of times over the course of the last 18 months, where the larger companies in the industry are looking at the sort of assets that are larger but in the middle of the industry or in the middle of the barbell that's here. And so I kind of go back to CACI's acquisition of 6-3 back in November of 2013 as one of the kind of catalysts for the recent market and a lot of activity where the buyers are taking advantage of these significant assets to move the needle on their strategy or on their financial performance or ultimately to make sure that they're deploying capital on behalf of their shareholders in an efficient and effective manner. I think we'll still see a lot of that larger deal activity over the coming 6 to 12 and maybe even 18 months as we get into the next election cycle.
Okay. What about deals like the CSC split or potential split from public sector to commercial sector, separating the businesses completely?
That's been a long rumored concept in this area. It'll be interesting to see what the fallout is or what ultimately happens in that situation. But again, it's a way to and maybe strategically think about how to get two assets that have very different models, that have very different cultures, and align them with shareholders and management teams that are ultimately going to be able to drive them more efficiently than they are today. What we do expect to see is a continued kind of effort on the larger companies to buy and build and position to be sustainable growth businesses. And that is a big driver of a lot of the smaller acquisitions that those companies have been doing, including CSC, who's been very active on the acquisition trail over the last few years, in addition to carving off parts of their portfolio and divesting pieces of business that weren't core to what they thought that the future was going to hold.
Cool. We're going to take a break. My guest today is Kevin DeSanto from Kips DeSanto. I'm Mark Amtower. You're listening to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Again, my guest is Kevin DeSanto of Kips DeSanto. Kips, K-I-P-P-S, DeSanto.com. You can also find Kevin on LinkedIn. So let's talk a little bit about the deals and the type of deals coming down the pike. What's going to be attractive to investors here?
Well, we have already talked a good bit about what I would characterize as the strategic buyer. The typical acquisition in the industry is the mid to large size business acquiring the smaller businesses, trying to bolster their customer capabilities, financial positioning, all of the things that we talked about earlier. One of the unique things that we've seen in the marketplace over the course of the last couple of years is that there are more and more alternative transactions that are available to companies and shareholders that are not necessarily all about full liquidity and not necessarily all about aligning with a larger organization, but to provide management teams and shareholders with ways to reduce risk and continue to grow or to position themselves for kind of longer term independent businesses. And one of the big transaction examples in that area is when a private equity group is coming in and buying a portion of the business, of the equity of the business from the existing owners and partnering with them to either build the business via acquisition or build the business in a more sophisticated fashion through organic growth and investment, or ultimately provide liquidity to shareholders at a point in time when they want to still be running the business and would like to start to build the nest egg or would like to put some money away or take some risk off the table. And so private equity activity over the course of the last few years has been about a third of the overall activity that we've seen. Over the last 2.5 years. So we look at 13, 14, and year to date.
Before that, correct me if I'm wrong, it didn't seem to be that significant of a factor.
It was a factor, but the market was more strategic in nature. It was less private equity in nature, and in terms of who the buyer was or what the transaction was.
Okay.
So that has been an increasing part of the overall opportunity for businesses in this marketplace. And that can mean two things. One is that it is a business where you're bringing in an outside investor that is going to, again, help you through the next 3 to 5 to 7 years of building the business. It can also mean that you are being acquired by a company that's already backed by private equity, which can give your shareholders and management an opportunity to invest in a business that's already down the path with a private equity group. So there's kind of two alternatives in there that have been relatively attractive. We've seen the most activity on the private equity side via the existing portfolio companies over the last 2.5 years, but we're still seeing consistent activity in private equity groups showing interest in the space and actually completing transactions, and we expect that to continue to occur over the coming years. The kind of second item that we're seeing is employee stock ownership plans, ESOPs, becoming a greater part of the overall transaction alternative that folks are considering. And ESOPs are an important and valuable tool for liquidity in the marketplace in general, but they are very specific to the culture and to the personality of the business, and
right.
is something that we have seen folks give more consideration of over the last few years than what we had historically seen.
Well, and it's a hell of a retention vehicle.
It can be a great retention vehicle. It can be a great way to create liquidity for a shareholder, especially if the desire is to stay independent, or if there aren't very many options that are available otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
This can be a useful tool. So we're seeing more of that. And I think both of those trends are a result of the pricing or the value of companies on a relative basis. We often talk about that in revenue multiples or EBITDA multiples, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. These are pricing terms where, historically they had been 10 plus times EBITDA for a business, and then the market sort of settled into 6, 7, 8 times for a business. So when the pricing contracts as it has over the last few years, you end up in a situation where other alternatives or other options become similarly attractive versus just an outright sale
for
a larger business, or possibly more attractive depending on what the risk profile is and whether or not it's the right timing for a transaction like that. So we're seeing things like that happen. In addition, I would say there's really a third wave that we've seen, which is leveraging the balance sheet to create what we would think of as an internal liquidity event, where you might be able to go to the bank and borrow more money today at a cheaper rate and provide liquidity or a dividend or a distribution to shareholders, or buy out a minority shareholder without having to bring in an outside investor or a strategic buyer. And that is, I think, a byproduct of the last few years. We've got situations where shareholders might be at a different point in their life. One older, one younger, one looking to retire, one looking to continue to do this for the next 10 years. There's a lot of those dynamics that have occurred because of, again, some of the challenges in the marketplace, but also some of the opportunity that folks are seeing in some of those signature areas that we talked about earlier. So, there are tending to be more ways for people to think creatively about how to drive liquidity or invest in the business. And I think that's encouraging for the marketplace overall. These businesses tend to be extremely strong from a financial vantage point. Low capital expenditures, high cash flow, good growth opportunities, good visibility, the types of things that lead to great assets to own and put us in a position where if we can think creatively and have folks that are willing to take on a little bit of risk, that you can really energize or supercharge the equity returns for the shareholders. Oftentimes it's a different wealth opportunity or a different value opportunity than what you just might see on an outright sale of the business today versus investing for 3 years and then selling the business.
Okay, two things come to mind here. private equity usually has a window that they operate in. I know that because you told me.
Mm-hmm.
Not something I normally would know. But I suspected as much just watching. So with a company like DLT, I think we may be on our third private equity group here. So why would a third company buy in? Why would the second company sell if there's still growth potential, profit potential there? I mean, is it just the model 3 to 5 and out?
It is generally a model. Every private equity group has a little bit of a different version of the model. And so what you'll see is that there are groups that are really good at the first 5 years. We would typically think of the venture community as being in a position where they are financing the early rounds of, and growth of a business. Then there is private equity that likes the growth stage of a business, but the sort of more mature teen years of that experience. And, you know, the third group would be the folks that want to own larger, more mature, more stable, less risky businesses, and they're willing to accept the lower returns that might be associated with that less risky business. And so we see a lot of different flavors of what investors are looking for and how they're thinking about the profile of a business. And there is a lot of folks in each of those buckets that are all looking to put capital to work. So, you know, in the a DLT type of situation, we see that very often where the investor profile changes because of the maturity level of the business or because of the return opportunities that are there. And irrespective of how long we think a business is going to grow, a investor wants to generate returns and to, you know, pay back their limited partners or the folks that are investing in their funds. And so the cycle tends to have a little bit of a kind of a formulaic approach to it, even though there is a little bit of wiggle room in all of those strategies.
Okay. One other aspect of this, we see companies often buying back their stock. And on rare occasion, companies, public companies going private. Does that happen often in the government market?
It is a it is something that has happened in the past, and it is something that you know, folks are always looking for opportunities to arbitrage the markets or create value in businesses while they're out of the public eye. And so we do see that from time to time. It is a strategy that's not too dissimilar to you know, the private equity group or the buyer acquiring a business in a non-public setting where you're looking to get an asset and optimize it and create efficiencies and not be beholden to the market on a quarterly basis, which can be a challenge for businesses at different points in their life cycle. And so there are significant opportunities to do that. A lot of good examples of that where the larger private equity firms have acquired the larger businesses in you know, either this or
CDW was acquired by a private equity firm and
exactly. Yeah, exactly. Businesses like WebSense that Raytheon just acquired and essentially merged their cybersecurity business with was a similar story, a public company that went private and ultimately is now a part of Raytheon.
Cool. All right, we're going to take our last break. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here with Kevin DeSanto of Kips DeSanto, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest today is Kevin DeSanto of Kips DeSanto. You can find them at KIPPS, KipsDeSanto.com. And you can find Kevin and his partner, Bob Kips, on LinkedIn. I suggest you do so, especially if you're getting ready to sell your company. So let's talk about the key drivers of value for defense and tech solutions here.
This is a great topic and one that's near and dear to our heart because this is what we're looking for and this is what we're trying to discern when we get a chance to meet companies and a chance to analyze their businesses is what is the right window to sell or find an investor when it's going to be the optimal transaction structure, which is likely to mean the highest price and likely to mean the best terms and conditions that are associated with it. And that window is really defined by two things. One is the characteristics of the business from a strategic or growth vantage point. And then the other is what is the sort of cleanliness or what is the organization of the business look like and how risky of a company is it? And so kind of splitting them into two different topics, I think the first is the more exciting of it, which is where are you positioned as a company and what are you going to be 3, 5, 7 years down the road? And in this industry, the main focal point for almost every buyer investor that we meet, no matter how they characterize it, is trying to determine what the sustainable growth profile of the revenue and profitability is. And that is a combination of hundreds, if not thousands, of data points in every organization, and is a byproduct of the existing contracts and task orders of a business, but also the pipeline that a business has and is able to confidently and very, very competitively chase after. And we spend a lot of time with our clients and with our prospective clients, making sure that we understand what that path is, because we know that any buyer and investor in the marketplace is going to ask questions about what has transpired over the last couple of years, but really what is going to happen over the next 2 to 3 to 4 years of the business and the life cycle that you're in. And so looking at things like your existing task orders and when those are up for recompete, looking at the life cycle of your existing contract vehicles and knowing when you're going to run out of the hunting license or run out of opportunity to continue to bid on things that you've been bidding over the years that you've owned the business. Certainly, a lot of what we see is capability driven, and folks wanting to understand whether or not you're bringing a capability set to the table that is differentiated or is hard to replicate or has been something that the buyer has struggled to build on their own organically. And then I would say the kind of third piece of the puzzle in terms of what they're thinking about are who the end markets are or who the customers are in that type of situation. And, you know, from our vantage point, you're looking at customers or end markets where the opportunity is going to be substantial over the longer term. Think 5, 10, 15 years versus just the near term. And ultimately, things that are going to be sexy or appealing from an investor vantage point. So when you put out the press release, is it going to catch the eye of the analysts or the investors? Or is it going to create a level of confidence in kind of what the future holds for that business directionally? And that's a very important component of what we see driving the value or driving the interest from a buyer in an asset in the marketplace. The other piece, and I find this to be an interesting one because it sometimes seems it's counterintuitive to folks in the marketplace, but the other piece of value that we see in companies is that they have an established infrastructure, in particular around business development and in a typical government contracting business, labor-based business, the recruiting mechanisms that are out there. And those two components tend to really drive value, and in particular business development. And you know, this idea of sustainable growth, business development is important because it is a mechanism that the buyer expects to continue without much investment post-transaction. And it's something that has to be capable of functioning on a full and open basis. And so, you know, oftentimes we're looking at pipelines and we're trying to find that window of opportunity when most of the opportunities that a company is bidding on are going to be in a full and open competition versus restricted to a small business or an 8A or another designation that might be available in that type of setting.
Yeah, I did an interview with Bob Lohfeld and Lisa Paife, both at Lohfeld Consulting, a couple weeks ago. And 2013 is looked at by BD people as a year of the BD layoff. Mm-hmm. A lot of companies laid people off. 2014, a lot of the major firms laid off bid and proposal shops. And 2015, from my point of view, is what the hell have we done? So I wonder how those might have factored in. Because, I mean, we're talking some fairly significant companies. Some of the top 10 players did some really slash and burn in their B&P shops.
This is just all driven by organic, sustainable growth when it comes to the acquisition value and the interest. And again, a lot of this gets lost in the weeds or in the buzzwords that we use to describe what's really happening. But fundamentally, you're looking to acquire a business that is going to be in a position to grow on its own and under your stewardship as a buyer and investor. And so having the right resources in your BD shop or your B&P assets, all of these things are incredibly important and mm-hmm. provide you credibility in showing a forecast that's going to certainly go up over time and putting yourself in a position where you're not being perceived as a business that is going to run out of steam or run out of gas along the way. And that is, it's a fundamental driver for this business. This is a very, very growth-oriented acquisition strategy by most of the companies in the sector. Other kind of piece of the puzzle from my thought process on this is the second component of what I mentioned earlier is having your organization clean and ready to go. And one of the things that we'll see is that companies, you get caught up in the day-to-day operations of the business and you don't think about what it all means. And having an organized back office and having books and records that are very, very solid and very credible is a very important component of this environment. Having financial statements that have been prepared by a reputable accounting firm, having your taxes filed in a way that is not leaving a lot of risk or issues for exposure on the table, having your contract documentation in a very organized manner, making sure that everybody in the organization is aware of what those contracts and documents say, even things down to teaming agreements and non-disclosure agreements that you've signed along the way, having signed copies of those saved into an area. There's so many fundamental things that you can do as an organization to be ready for the incredible due diligence that comes along with the acquisition or investment that we've been talking about today. So it oftentimes gets overlooked, but something that we can't stress enough is people focusing on building an organization that is rock solid from the bottom up. And ultimately, the things that people are going to get most excited about are going to be the growth and the customers and the capability sets. And as long as that's being done in a very, very profitable manner or as profitable as can be for that marketplace, there's an opportunity to do one of the many transactions that we talked about today when the window is open for companies in this industry.
Cool. Give me some final thoughts here.
I'd say first, thank you for having me. Always great to catch up and chat. And second, you know, it's a dynamic marketplace. And you know, if I were in the shoes of a CEO or shareholder right now, I'd be seeking out guidance and advice and making sure that I was timing up my strategy and aligning my personal interests with those of the business and the industry, and making sure that you don't miss either a window of opportunity that's here today or identifying the one that's down the road.
Yeah, and let's touch on that briefly. When a company, especially a smaller firm's, thinking about selling, what kind of time window should they be thinking about here?
It's about a 6 to 9 month process to complete the transaction.
Once you find a buyer.
Well, and just in general. So okay. For us, from a client relationship vantage point, it would typically be in a 6 to 9 month window. Obviously, we all love it to be shorter, but it just tends to fall into that range. And it is it's an arduous process, so you have to be ready for it. You have to have your priorities aligned and your objectives set and be ready to commit the additional resources to it. We joke that it's a second job, but frankly, most of our clients already have a second job, so it's a third or fourth, and it is as much fun as we have doing it. It is a grind, and it is something that you know, we want everybody to be ready for, which really does tie back into finding the right window of opportunity to do it. And knowing that it's going to take time to do it the right way.
Cool. Kevin, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Mark. Really appreciate it.
My guest today has been Kevin DeSanto of Kipps DeSanto. Again, you can find him at Kipps, K-I-P-P-S, DeSanto.com. This is not my day job. If you need advice on marketing to the government, particularly on leveraging social media, LinkedIn, give me a shout, mark@federaldirect.net. And my Government Market Master Continuing Professional Education offers classes every month in Columbia, Maryland. Drop me a line for details. And thank you for listening to AmTower Off-Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off-Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.